Today is Tuesday, May 1st, 2012. My name is Yana Owens, and I'm interviewing Linda Jewell via Skype for the Lewis Clark Oral Histories Project. In 1970, Linda graduated from the North Carolina State University School of Design in Architecture. In 1975, she earned her Master's in Landscape Architecture from the University of Pennsylvania. Her distinguished career in education, practice, and publication is well recognized. For instance, she received the Presidential Award in Communications for her 10 years of construction articles in Landscape Architecture magazine. And in 2008, she was awarded the Jot D. Carpenter Teaching Medal. Since 1991, Linda has been a professor of landscape architecture and urban design at the University of California, Berkeley. She has been a fellow of the ASLA since 1994. Hello, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. To start us off, tell me a little bit about where you're from and what kinds of interests you had as you were growing up.
Well, I was raised in Sanford, and my father and grandfather owned a construction firm. They had both studied engineering at NC State, and so I grew up around the construction industry and designers and architects, and so I had always had an interest in architecture, even though at the time it was not something that women were usually interested in.
I can imagine. So you were drawn to NCSU School Design because your family had been there, I guess.
Oh,
is that right?
Yes. Yes. I was a third generation, and there have been some after me. So.
That's wonderful. Well, what kind of discrimination against women architecture students did you run into?
There was nothing, wasn't so much as blatant discrimination other than things like limited bathrooms and all of that, as there was, you just felt like such an odd duck, I think. There were certainly assumptions that you were not going to make it. There were assumptions that if you did, that you were somehow not feminine. I had one in my fourth year, an instructor call me in and say that he had only met three women that were good architects, and two of them he didn't consider women.
Oh, my gosh.
So there were also, on occasions, issues of not so much direct harassment, but more attention than one might want from faculty and senior people that were around.
What was your strategy in how to handle things like that?
Just to focus on my work, and I had really good relationships with my colleagues, my fellow students. And I think that was the most important thing. And those friendships have lasted a lifetime.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And so I think that I had always been, growing up, kind of one of the boys. Most of my friends in high school, I had two very close girlfriends, but I had a lot of close friends that were men when I was growing up in high school. Wasn't exactly a tomboy, but I was just very comfortable with male friends, and I think that helped me a lot to be in a classroom full of men.
Right.
Sometimes, and one of the things I do remember, and it wasn't in the design school, but we used to take some of our preliminary structures courses, engineering mechanics, down in engineering, and I remember once in that class, there was one other woman. She had actually been my college roommate for a while, who was still in architecture through the third semester as a classmate, and then she transferred out into math. And so we were the only two women in that class, and there must have been about over 100 men. And you had to enter behind the instructor.
Uh-huh.
And the way it was, I've forgotten, one of those engineering buildings. And, of course, I had swimming the class beforehand, so I was always late. I always had to enter this room
right.
with over 100 men,
oh, no.
and it was just a horrendous experience.
Very
so I have memories of, you know, some of it has to do with being on the state campus more than it has to do with being in the School of Design.
Really?
Because of... there were just so few women on campus, and so when you were out of the shelter of people that you knew well, that made it very awkward. I also had a couple of funny run-ins with Dean Kamphefner. At the time, this is a good story. They had the dorm had opened, the one dorm with 90 women over at Watauga Hall. But we had to be in at 11 o'clock or you had to stay out all night.
Uh-oh.
It was one or the other. They locked the doors. And so on charrette, sometimes I would stay out overnight. And then if I wanted to get a nap, I would go down. There was a woman's restroom down below with a little couch in it. And I slept there. And I had left my sheet on the couch, and someone had turned him into Dean Kamphefner, and he called me, put a note on my desk in my studio. It was in Bob Burns' studio, and I had to go in and sit and talk to Kamphefner, and he had my polka-dotted sheets with my name tag in them on his desk.
Oh, no.
And I'd been up for nights, and little tears started coming down my eye as he was, you know, asking me what I was doing, and he didn't believe that I had to stay out all night.
Really?
And he called the dean of women when I told him. He said, that can't be. They wouldn't make a rule like that. I said, they do. And he called the dean of women about it, and I remember him saying, "Well, that's ridiculous," and shaming and slamming down the phone.
Uh-huh.
And by that point, the little tear was coming down my eyes. And then I thought that he was indicating something improper that I was doing, and something unladylike.
Right.
And then he became all apologetic and concerned.
Oh.
So there are lots of little stories. You know, I think any woman in that period that was in the school has funny stories like that. But often, you know, what kept you going were the guys in your classes.
Really?
You know, and the few women that were around, you know. But they usually weren't in your own class. They were above or below you.
Right. Well, Lewis Clark was still teaching when you first arrived. Did you have him for any studios or classes?
No, I didn't, but I did have him for critiques. At the time I was there in the second year, you did a series of studios. Whatever your major, you did at least half a semester in one of the other majors. And so I did half a semester in landscape architecture, and I had Bob Phillips, who was an excellent teacher. And he had Lewis in on several reviews. Roberta Burley Marks visited that semester, and he came in and did critiques and talked to us in our studio. And so I was very well aware of Lewis as an architecture student. And after that studio, which I did well in, I guess he was chair at that point, but I remember he and Bob, and maybe Bob Moore was around too. You know, they were all kind of mysterious faces. I didn't know them that well.
Right.
And they had, I remember sitting in one of them's office, and I think it was Lewis's, and they were trying to convince me that I should study landscape architecture. And I passed on it at that point.
Right.
Anyway, I actually finished out the year and as a product design major, and then went back into architecture at the beginning of my third year.
You changed over to product design?
Just briefly. The lure of Vince Foote. I had Vince Foote as an instructor as well during that series. And I thought, well, I think product design would be nice, and visual design. And it was a very colorful group that were teaching
right
in there. And so that was very, very brief. I don't know if Vince even remembers I was briefly a product design major, probably.
Well, I think that's news to a lot of people.
So it didn't last long, and by the beginning of third year, I was hurrying around trying to get back into a studio so that I wasn't out of sequence, so that I didn't lose any time.
Well, I think we're all glad that you dropped product design and came back over to the architecture side of the house at that point. So you had, what I'm hearing here is that you had a little exposure to landscape architecture.
Yes, definitely.
And so I know that there was when you graduated in 70, you were about to, somehow you went through a transition or a meeting with people, or I'm not sure, you'll have to tell me. How did you end up going to the University of Pennsylvania to get your master's in landscape architecture?
Well, it was kind of a sequence of things. After I graduated, my first job actually was with Ligg & Flynn. He had at times just myself, and at other times one other employee. And we hung out in the ramp under Dick Bell's gallery out there. So most of our work came in through Dick's office, actually. Mm-hmm. And so I became familiar with what was going on in that office. And they were doing a lot of interesting work, and there were a lot of colorful people, some of them teaching at State at that point. And that had started when I was in my fifth year. I think the whole time I was in architecture, at State during that period, landscape architecture had a very high visibility within the total school, and so it was always kind of hanging out there as an interest, partially because some of the personalities, I saw it as exciting. I was still primarily interested in architecture, though. And so I worked for Ligg for about a year.
What kind of projects did y'all work on?
Worked on Bald Head Island.
It was that time at Bill's office then.
Yeah, and also on, not Bald Head Island, I'm sorry, Figure Eight Island.
Right.
Bald Head was my own firm later. Worked on Figure Eight Island, worked on the Polly's Island. When I was first hired, I did drawings for the Polly Islands condominiums that Ligon was doing, and that Dick had worked on that as well, though that was primarily Ligon's project.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of houses down at Figure Eight and in the Wilmington area. It was all kind of resort-oriented work. So then I moved to Washington, D.C., and I worked for a couple of architecture firms there. And one of them was a larger firm, and there were two architects/landscape architects who had gone to Penn, and we worked on a national competition for a corporate headquarters out in Colorado. It was an invited competition, and these landscape architects had started pulling out the soils maps and doing all of these things that I knew nothing about, and I thought, ooh, there's a whole world here that I don't quite understand. I had gone through that once before. In part of my fifth year, I had done a studio over at Chapel Hill, where they had, it was a planning studio for Newtown, and there had been a landscape architect who was doing his PhD in planning on that team, and during that process, he would pull out the soils maps and talk about the watershed and where the hydrology, how the hydrology was working, and it was all very mysterious to me.
Right.
And so I was aware that there was this whole area of knowledge that was important to design that I didn't know about. In my fifth year at State, I had heard McCarg speak, and I think anyone that ever heard him speak was moved to do something about the quality of our landscapes. And so McCarg was always there in my mind. So when I started thinking about, after being working in Washington and, you know, just turning out construction drawings and getting a little bit bored, I began to think about going back to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure if I was interested in urban design or architecture or landscape architecture. And I visited some schools. I considered going back to state to do my master's in architecture, but it seemed maybe it wasn't new enough for me. And I visited Penn, and I was both interested in Lucan's studio and McCarg and the urban design program. And McCarg had heard me in the office. I mean, I now know this is his strategy, but, you know, just by happenstance, he got on the elevator with me as I went up to the urban design office. And, of course, by the time I got off, I was going to apply for landscape architecture.
Well, tell me some more about McCarg. He was a rather charismatic person, as I understand.
That's an understatement. and he had a really interesting relationship with Lewis. You know, my contact with Lewis has been fairly askance. You know, I mean, he's been there for a long time, but I never worked with him or had him as an instructor or anything like that. I've just known him. But then when I did start at Penn, and the first day, and we do the go-around of where everyone was from, and it was, and they did the two-year people with background in architecture all in one, as a separate group from the three-year students, and all but one of my classmates were international students. It was after design, it was right at the peak of Design with Nature, getting out into the world. And everybody wanted to come and study with McCarg. So it was a very, very impressive group of people. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, finally there's, and they were all men. And so here I was with my Southern accent, and I explained where I was, and I, you know, where I'd come from and what my background was. And the first thing McCarg says, oh, well, you must know Lewis Clark.
Really?
Yeah. And so it was very, I was very aware in all my contact with Lewis, I mean with McCarg, that Lewis had played a key role in his work. They went through a period where there was a conflict that I'm aware of. I never knew the details that had something to do with one of the projects down on the coast. And I don't, I don't know the background on that. So. Mm-hmm. Ian would often get huffy about Lewis, but it was also very clear, and he very often said, well, you know, he's the one that sort of got me started on this whole ecological analysis. And even in his biography, he mentions that.
Right.
That when he had Lewis come up to teach at Penn, that was their first ecological inventory study. Mm-hmm. And that Lewis, the fact that Lewis had worked for Brian Hackett, and that Lewis then brought the thinking behind doing an ecological analysis to his work. And I guess Lewis had probably been doing it, teaching it, and using it at State before Ian started at Penn. I don't
well,
know.
Well, as I understand it, Lewis was going around the country frequently visiting universities to describe the reconnaissance methodology and the overlay strategy. And he has said in the past that McCarg invited him up when the department was first getting started, and they had given him 3 years to get the department back, you know, back in line again, since it had been kind of defunct for a while. And so he said he remembers that he and McCarg would talk about things, but that they never really discussed the what Lewis discussed in his lectures or his presentations at Penn. But he said it wasn't very long after he stopped going up there. You know, he'd finished his semester of work and everything. It wasn't very long after that where he started realizing that McCarg was actually understanding what he was talking about and was starting to develop in a different direction, compatible direction, but just a slightly different direction from what Lewis was doing.
Mm-hmm. I do know.
It was an important meeting. I'm glad you brought that up because it's a very important intersection in the history of landscape architecture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was key, I think. And my understanding, I don't know if you've looked at Fritz Steiner's biography of McCarg, but in there he speaks to that period, so you might want to take a look at that.
Okay.
And my understanding is that Lewis did some kind of short studio project or something where some kind of inventory was taken.
They and did that, the Schuylkill River?
Maybe that was it. Maybe that was it. And that influenced Ian. And, I mean, several times I have heard over the years from when I was a student, and, you know, he says, oh, well, you must know Lewis Clark, and he started talking to me mm-hmm. about Lewis's work, to years later, just before I left NC State when I was teaching there in the late 70s, early 80s, I don't remember when the lecture was, and Ian said in the lecture that he gave Lewis credit again, and I heard him do it, and he does in his biography as well, right. as having influenced him to start in that direction.
I think that's really
significant.
Yes, it is tremendously. Well, after graduating from Penn, you joined the NCSU School Design faculty as an assistant professor,
mm-hmm.
and by that time, Dean Kamphefner had retired, and Claude McKinney had been dean for mm-hmm. about 2 years. How did the school design reflect this change in leadership?
Oh, wow. Well, it was, you know, it was, McKinney was certainly more of a collaborative, set up more of a collaborative environment. I mean, you know, it's no secret that Kamphefner was an autocrat and proud of it.
Right.
And McKinney operated in a different way. I mean, he came out of the sort of, you know, the focus group culture and the sort of let's hear everyone's opinion and try to reach some consensus here. It was much more of that environment, I guess. But, you know, in the trenches, I'm not sure how much difference it really made. Mm-hmm. It was still a pretty, to me, a pretty similar place. And I had, you know, and now I was in landscape architecture, so mostly, I don't know, I'm not sure I had enough insight to really understand because my role was so different mm-hmm. as an instructor from having been a student.
Right.
It still was a vital and a creative place, you know, which it still is.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, it's a pretty amazing institution.
It really is. Well, you nominated Lewis Clark for his ASLA fellow, which you received in 1980. And
uh-huh.
there's quite a bit of work involved in the process. And
uh-huh.
Lewis has certainly been grateful to you ever since then for doing what you did. But what about Lewis's work? Did you feel was important to have recognized?
Well, that's interesting. I was motivated, and I was kind of shocked. I, as a young person, and having not that many links in the area any longer, though I had some, I was shocked to find out that neither he nor Dick Bell were fellows. And so, as a new officer, I thought, well, you know, I should do something about this.
Right.
Because I saw them both as significant figures in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And was so aware through Ian of Lewis's work. I had known of Lewis's work a long time. I know Lewis did a lot of work with Tommy Hayes. And Tommy Hayes was a family friend, such as it could be. he was a very... had a very powerful personality, I'll say. And my grandfather had known him when he was a kid. He and my dad did I don't know how many projects together, a lot.
Right.
He had designed the renovation of the house that I lived in. So I had always, for a long time, I had known of Lewis's work partially because of having worked with Hayes, partially just because he was a colorful figure at the School of Design.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the era of coming, you know, having come from architecture and studied landscape architecture in the mid-70s when everyone was so focused on ecological analysis and environmental planning, I also saw Lewis as someone that was still advocating design. of the landscape, that this was an important part of what we did. We didn't just do analysis in master plans, of which obviously he did a great deal, but he was a modernist, and I was certainly of that. I had grown up with that sensibility, having grown up in a Tommy Hayes house.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this was the era of, I watch Mad Men, and I say, oh, well, there's my life I grew up with. this looks all very familiar to me. And so I saw Lewis as an advocate for design of the landscape, and that the landscape was more than just a sort of leftover space where you place modern buildings as well, that you actually organized and modified and highlighted a site. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the key roles of a landscape architect, is to understand the natural systems and the ecology of a site in a way so that then when interventions are made into that landscape, that they are thoughtful about how they accommodate and in fact highlight the natural features of a landscape. And I saw his work as doing that. Most of the work I was familiar with through images, awards images, you know, for the local AIA.
Right.
I was aware, I mean, I was just kind of aware of what the office was doing or had been doing. And I would talk to people through the ASLA, and I would see the awards, and it just seemed that he was, you know, he was the person that was really plugging for both design and ecological analysis, and that it was a single entity, that it was not one thing and then something else.
Right.
And so he interests me for that reason.
Well, that's I haven't ever heard anybody really put it in those words, but I think that's the differentiation there of what was going on, the trend towards reading statistics as opposed to what do they mean for the design.
Well, it was, you know, it was Ian's determinism, and I mean, I, you know, I was very close to Ian and I adored him, but the determinism drove me crazy.
Right.
As though, you know, and he had convinced himself, and the funny thing is, Ian was a very intuitive person who drew beautifully. I think he was a talented designer, which most people don't realize. He, you know, having worked with him in a couple of projects, I saw that, you know, through firsthand contact, but he was on a mission, and I understand that mission. And as a part of that mission, he had resorted to a very deterministic philosophy, and he was convinced, boy, if you had enough data, it would tell you exactly what to do, except maybe the paint color.
Really?
And if you had a little more data, it would tell you the paint color. You just couldn't always get all that data.
Right.
I don't know. I think he preached that, but at times I'm not completely sure he completely believed it. But it had permeated certainly landscape architecture education, mm-hmm. to the point that design education was very limited. It was very limited at Penn. I was quite frustrated at times, and McCard was certainly aware of that, in that I wanted to transfer my very excellent design training as an architect into designing landscapes. And fortunately, in my final semester, Lori Olin came in as a lecturer, and he sort of pulled me out of my depression and helped me on a project that McCard had been advising me on. I had pulled out of the normal studio sequence.
Right.
And to work on this project, and it was a competition, and I got a great education, but I kind of had to pull some things together for myself, because, and Penn wasn't the only place, every place in the country really was teaching primarily analysis and planning ecological analysis and very little design. And so I had to rely on my architectural education for that.
Right. Yeah. Well, from 1987 to 1991... Can you hear me, Linda? I'm getting a little feedback here. Okay. From 1987 to 1991, you were chair and adjunct professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Design. Were you the first female chair at GSD?
I was.
And what were some of the challenges in that position?
Well, it wasn't just that I was the first woman chair. I was also quite young. I was still in my 30s to be doing that position. Well, the GSD certainly was, until recently, still, and may still be, a male world, but I was used to that. I think mostly I was just so concerned and delighted with the opportunity to in some way contribute to once again having landscape architecture move into the realm of design and beyond just deterministic planning. At the same time, you know, and I make it sound like I was sort of anti the ecological analysis. I wasn't. I think that my education of understanding natural systems at Penn was terrific and a real gift. But that integration of that understanding into making design proposals is what I was interested in, and it gave me, you know, the best platform in the world to contribute to that. And so that was what I was really focused on. In a way, I was just so much sort of fighting for the department and for the discipline, I think, more than as a woman. Although there were, you know, there were any number of things that happened and that I'd rather not go into that were, you know, not right, in terms of having been the first woman, what that meant in terms of certain kinds of expectations and the failure to be mentored in the way that my male colleagues were. I mean, it was very typical in education. It's still a struggle, I think, for women in design education.
Well, that kind of leads to my next question. What advice do you give to women who complain about not being taken seriously as architects and landscape architects?
Promote yourself. I think we're really, when you're taken, in the world is designed particularly today, and I'm not good at this, so I can you know, I can recommend it while not doing it very well myself. It has become much more of a world of promotion. And you can't sit back and wait for somebody to notice that you're doing good work. You have to promote it. You have to actively seek it out. You have to have a strategy and an agenda to get your name out there. And then when you have all that ammunition, it sets you up in a better situation not to be ignored. And you have to speak up when you think that something is not okay, mm-hmm. in terms of a decision that is made, a judgment that is made, a comment that is made. You know, I had to learn, and I'd say definitely this at the GSD, I had to learn to speak up in an assertive but not confrontational way. And it can pay off, because the other thing is to look out for the colleagues that are helpful and to really ask for their advocacy.
Right. I like to recommend your Women in Landscape Architecture Essays on History and Practice that you edited with Louise Mazingo. I think that's a really good collection of advice and history.
It really is. It really is. And I wish, this is kind of classic of me, I was so busy trying to you know, do other things in the department. I wasn't able to get my own essay in there, which I wish I had.
Well, we'll look for that in the future.
Yeah, in the future. Sally's is quite delightful.
Oh, Sally Showman's, right?
Yeah, yes. Sally's was a real key in that.
That's
in that
wonderful.
Publication.
Well, let's go move on to something else you've written. You've written that the relationship between landscapes and structures fascinates me. And so is there ever a point where a design is equally favorable for the landscape and the structure? And if so, what is it?
Well, it happens to be, I don't think there are many examples out there, but the examples that I have chosen to look at is American Outdoor Theaters. And I've been working on a research project, had an exhibition that has been in a number of places, including the School of Design some years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've been very slow to get the book out, but I'm still working on it. And these theaters, and I think Red Rocks in Colorado is a great example, Swarthmore Theater in up in Pennsylvania. I think there's the Marin Theater out here. I think actually Dick Bell's theater at Meredith, mm-hmm. Theater at Chapel Hill. There are a lot of these theater structures where you really, it's clear there was this conversation between the structural intervention and the landscape itself, in that, you know, it's almost like, well, the structure, because it has certain kinds of programmatic needs, says, I want to be like this. Right. The landscape says, oh, but I've got a root system over here, or I have a canopy, you know, I've got an existing slope that is this, or a little bedrock that is this, and it pushes back and sort of helps reshape what that idealized typology of a theater is. And then the typology pushes back, and it's this back and forth, literally a conversation between the structure and the landscape that is orchestrated by the designer. And sometimes those designers were architects, and sometimes they were landscape architects. And so by looking at these theaters, I've begun to try to understand why they worked in the way that they do, in that they are workable dynamic structures at the same time they interpret and highlight the landscape. Mm-hmm. And that a key to that was that the designers, whether they were architect or landscape architect, spent a lot of time being on the landscape and seeing the landscape. Mm-hmm. And I think and that made a difference. It made a difference. And I think that that can happen in structures as well. I mean, I think one of the reasons I'm interested in landscape architecture has as much to do with Harwell Hamilton Harris as it does any of the, you know, other faculty. Because Harwell, every building he did, he really looked carefully at the landscape. And, well, I can't say everyone because I haven't checked out everyone, but certainly the one I know the best, the Harwell, Havens House here in Berkeley, it's an extraordinary sort of push and pull between this dynamic structural intervention and accommodating a very complex and difficult landscape setting. And so it, you know, there was this push and pull. Mm-hmm. And it's not where where it sort of adds up to a zero in terms of, or maybe you say to 100, depending on your the way you look at it.
Right.
That each one complements the other and neither one dominates. And I think, so that's what, that interests me. And I don't think, and not every setting needs to be like that, but I think that when you have that, you have very special places that are important in our lives.
Well, we really like the Coca Booth Amphitheater here in Cary.
Oh, well, we spent a lot of time on the site. And I think my big contribution to that was to really force everybody. You know, we did a several-day charrette right there at the site, and there were people from, Cary Recreation. There were people from the Symphony. There were a whole collection of and the consultants, and Bill was down from Boston, and we were just all there.
That was Bill who?
Ron, who was the architect that did the structure,
right.
And then Alan, I just went blank on his last name, who was working in his office and then went out on his own, and he was really the, in many ways, the very involved designer on the project, along with Sam Reynolds. And we all, we worked in a model. We had built a base model and inside the conference room, and everybody would do little diagrams. I showed everyone my collection at that point from the exhibition of outdoor theaters across the country, and people kept talking about and doing little diagrams with this little sort of tiny pea in this huge forest, and I said, you know, I'm not sure that's what we've got here.
What was different?
After the first day, I said to Sam, I said, can we get somebody to go over to the hardware store and get us some orange construction tape and some stakes? I think we need to stake out the size of this stage and what they're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And there was pressure to put VIP seating and reshape the entire place in order to have very structured seating right next to the stage, and then as a result of that, you'd have to really reshape the all the area behind it so that people could see anything.
Right.
And so we went out and started putting the stage in different locations, actually staking it on the ground, and in that process made the suggestion that perhaps we could have a privileged area there in the very back on a raised platform, and therefore avoid a major reshaping of the topography so that we could save the pine, you know, a lot of the pine trees.
Right.
And originally we even had pine trees right in the middle, but the administrators finally decided that was not a good thing, and they took out some of those pine trees, which I personally think is unfortunate, even though I appreciate why they did it.
Right.
And so with some very careful, after we had done that conceptually, I mean, that was the big step in my mind, because if you had to regrade that auditorium space, you would have destroyed the entire site.
That's true.
And so, with Sam's great skill at grading and this sort of concept, and Bill Ron's great skill as an architect, and in those charrettes when we were on the site, and we kept talking about that the structure itself should reflect something about the pine trees, we had some sandwiches with some really long toothpicks in it. I have a great slide of this. And we started making the structure for the stage with out of these long toothpicks and sticking it into our model, which began and to give form to what that, you know, to what the stage structure eventually was. And that's really where that sort of soaring, that all came, that whole basic scheme that, of course, was carried out, I feel, really well by Sam and Bill. We essentially designed the overall layout in those 3 days, though, by going back and forth between looking at the site, really understanding that landscape, which was very flat to build a theater on.
Right. The point is that you didn't sit in front of your CAD-loaded computer and design that amphitheater.
Absolutely. And I'm sure Lewis never just sat in front of a drawing board. When you look at the real masters in our field that are now in, you know, that are in their late 70s, and Pete Walker's about to turn 80, but Rich Haig, Lewis, all the ones that are now in their 80s are the ones that are recently deceased, whether it was Royston, Halprin, who I was lucky enough to get to know fairly well. They really knew how to look at and understand the site.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent time. You know, they spent time going out, sketching it, looking at it carefully, and there is not enough of that, I think, ongoing in the field today. We really fight to try to keep that kind of learning a part of our education here at Berkeley, and I think some other schools do too.
I think it's turning around. I think there's been a period where we didn't. I mean, maybe we were too enamored with CAD's abilities,
yeah.
And now we're starting to go, wait a minute, this is not what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be out there actually doing some walking
yeah.
around and seeing.
Yeah, because, you know, going out and drawing the landscape, it's not so much about the drawings you produce, it's what you learn and what you observe in the process of doing the drawing.
Right.
You know.
Well, a number of individuals who have been interviewed for this Oral Histories project have degrees or special training beyond landscape architecture, or did it the reverse way that you did, architecture back to landscape architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Should today's landscape architects have more than one area of expertise?
Oh, I think some of them need to, and others need to just spend their lives focusing on landscape architecture. I mean, I think we need both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there are a lot of people, I know there are people that have backgrounds in landscape architecture. I think of one person in particular in the Boston area that has focused on soils. And his first, he also had a degree in, I don't remember what, ag engineering or something, mm-hmm. soil science. And he has worked as a consultant on all of the major sort of landmark constructed landscape projects in the country, and as a consultant to other high-profile firms. And so we need people like that, because he understands what it means to be a landscape architect, same with people maybe that deal with water, hydrology, forest or stream restoration, marsh restoration. We need those people that have that expertise, and I think if they also have a background in landscape architecture, they're really golden in mm-hmm. terms of providing expertise to other designers. But we also need the people that are just grounded and passionate about making landscapes.
Well, it kind of is a pointless question, maybe, after such a good explanation of what kinds of things that landscape architects can contribute to. But by today's definition, what does a landscape architect do?
Well, I think we're still about, I think the primary thing that we should do is interpret the landscape. So when whether we're building playing fields or building a garden on top of a roof deck or collecting water for sustainable goals, which I think is certainly, I mean, it's almost like why talk about it, because everybody talks about it. I think we are, the world has gotten on to what we've been advocating for 150 years, and that is more concern for long-term sustainable development. But on top of that, I think we are the ones, because we look and understand how a landscape functions and the tie between what it's experiencing it is like and how it functions, that we are the ones that can provide that layer of interpretation of a particular landscape, and let that inform a design proposal, if it physical changes of that. So we're still about physical changes in the landscape and how to accommodate them in the best possible way for long-term health and spiritual interpretation of that landscape.
So you don't see the landscape architect or professor going out of existence at this point?
No, I think we're in the best shape we've been in a long time.
That is
ever.
Very encouraging.
I mean, since the Olmsted days, really.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there have been sort of three big peak area times, and certainly one was the time of the Olmsted firm in the early days.
Uh-huh.
And then I think under McCarg, we certainly peaked in terms of international visibility with the population in general, but it was primarily focused on ecological analysis. And I think now, because of the rise of a concern for sustainability, even through the downturn, our students have been finding jobs. It's not been that way in architecture. And just before the downturn, there was such a shortage of landscape architects. Mm-hmm. Across the country, I felt like I could, I could open a brokerage firm and made a lot of money trying to as some kind of headhunter for former students to firms out there, uh-huh. because all firms in the country were looking for good people, and there was a shortage. And I, as people begin to build again, I think it's going to happen again. Although that certainly the number of programs has grown, and the number that the schools are producing has begun to increase finally, mm-hmm. because it had been at a kind of steady pace of very modest increase for quite a while.
Right. What is the one important thing to know about Linda Jewell?
Oh, wow. I feel strongly about, from a professional design educator standpoint, that our field, the design fields, have to be about the human being and the creative impulse and long-term ecological health all rolled up into one, and that it's tough, it's hard, and that you can't get overly, and I hope I don't get overly taken with one aspect of that three-legged stool, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Creative expression, ecological health, and human experience. I mean, those are the three legs of the stool, mm-hmm. that you want to keep juggling, and that you want to give proper accommodation to all three. And then, so I think that's what I'm about, certainly as a professional and a teacher. I think there are other things about me as an individual.
Would you like to share any of those?
I like to think I was a good mom.
I'm sure you have been. Well, Linda, those are all of my questions for today. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Just that I think Lewis's contribution to the field has probably not been fully appreciated. And I think this whole thing of, he's so representative. He's both representative of a very important era, and that is the modern sensibility of, 1950 to mm-hmm. 2000 plus. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, he was at the forefront of very many things within that period, and that he's... not as well known as he might be. And so I hope this collection will help remedy that.
Well, that's kind of our goal. So with humility and perseverance, we seem to be doing okay at this point.
Yeah, it's great that you're doing this.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation, so thanks again for agreeing to be interviewed.
Okay.
And we'll see you.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.